So I suggested the last couple Sundays that there's a real dramatic sequence in these readings from that. The first Sunday, the temptation. Second Sunday, the kind of obliteration of the evil that was created by the temptation. And Jesus appears in this kind of final end stage, his face shiny, garment white. So that what happened initially, where people were ashamed to be with each other, in Jesus is reversed, because Jesus was not ashamed to be with anybody, and so God chose him and raised him from the dead. And I suggested that our problem is, how do we get from where we are, where we still are ashamed to be who we are before each other, to that openness, that utter transparency? This is the kingdom condition. And this reading from John is an extraordinary piece of writing, whoever put it together. And it's important to remember at the outset, John, or whoever wrote this, or it was written by a whole bunch of people, as a matter of fact, still did not believe Jesus is divine. When they say Jesus is Messiah, that does not mean that Jesus is divine. It means he's God's agent. Huh? And he's created this stunning story to express his, or some people think it's her, faith as to what was the nature and the character of this man Jesus and what impact he had on the world. And nothing is wasted in the story. So here you have a Jew in this central area of Palestine, so here's Galilee, Judea, and Samaria, this section in the middle, and these were these kind of half-breed heterodox Jews with their own temple and very much under suspicion by the Jews up north and down south. Remember the Good Samaritan. You know, the Good Samaritan, that parable in Luke, is an oxymoron. There's no such thing as a Good Samaritan. But here's Jesus talking to a woman, first of all, publicly, a Samaritan woman, even worse, and one of questionable virtue, even worse. But you notice he doesn't harangue her. Now, listen, lady, fix up your life. He's simply there. He's simply there. And in the presence of this man, you find this altogether remarkable transformation, where she comes to admit that, yeah, she has had a number of male partners. But then she goes into town, where she's probably well known as a woman of easy virtue, and is able to say to these people, here I am, and this man has told me everything I am. In other words, we see a kind of growth in transparency in this woman's life simply by contact, by being in the presence of this man, this non-accusatory, non-judgmental, simply accepting benign figure. And even the little details, like she came, it was about noon, huh? Nobody in the right mind would go out in noon to pick up water. She did it because she knew nobody would be there, so nobody would see her, and she wouldn't have to endure people's scorn and contempt. It is this woman that Jesus talks about giving her somehow a new source of life, this living water. What I'd like to suggest, and this is only one of many possible readings, that one way of making sense of this passage, to see it as a stage in our conversion, is it is a move from self-righteousness, the woman who's not about to say who she is or what she is, to this movement of real transparency. So she can talk to these other people about who she is, do it without shame. What is there about self-righteousness, which I think is a kind of endemic to the human condition? I think the most notable thing about self-righteousness is it's exclusionary. It privileges my point of view.
over against everybody else, and therefore separates me from people. And it's basically, I think, due to the effort that we all need to justify our existences. I think self-righteousness is simply another exercise in self-justification, which is, again, is a highly privatized form of human existence. But not only does it detach us from other people, it reduces other people to abstractions. This is my opinion, that's your opinion. Remember, we used to say, error has no rights. In the church. That was official position of the church. Error has no rights. John the 23rd says there is no such thing as error. Only people who make mistakes. And nothing that anybody does abrogates their right to be taken seriously as a fellow human being. Nothing. This does not mean that all opinions are of equal value or validity, but it seems to me, in thinking about myself and my attempts at self-justification and self-righteousness, that there's a long history that has created that impulse in me. A history where the search for truth has been thwarted, frustrated, diminished, in me by my memories and disappointments, which is given the urgency to the pressure to be self-righteous. Not a particularly healthy response. And basically it's a form of greed, I think, finally, in the end. It's a form of greed. I want to possess this. I want to possess this. Possessing this, I can exclude everybody else. I don't have to take other people seriously as people. But I can reduce everybody to positions. I mean, we in academia run into this with great regularity. So what is embedded, I think, at the deepest level in this passage is this. We see this woman, like all of us human beings, still wants the truth. Still wants the truth. The truth of who she is. The truth of the other people who respond to her in this violent or contemptuous way. And of course, there's one of the great sadnesses of life that all of us, I think, are constitutionally orientated to the truth, that orientation is so diminished and misshapen and malformed by our experiences. So again, the person who put this story today has done a quite astonishing thing. In the presence of this man, this woman need not be ashamed. Can be open, and even if people still hold her in contempt, that's secondary. There's a moment of liberation here that we can hope is, well, historically we don't know what happened. That it's not going to be reversible. That she can live with a freedom and an openness that she didn't have before. So as I said, the first Sunday of Lent, so we get the temptation, and then we get the end process, and then the question is, how do we get from here to there? And that's what the rest of the Lent is about. Something in us must die in order for something else to be reborn. The desire, the passion to justify, to rationalize our own superiority, self-righteousness, which, as I said, removes us from each other. That must die. That must die. in order that some larger, truer, deeper life may emerge. I mentioned this book by Sebastian Moore, which has arrived, by the way. Moore has this stunning image. He talks about desire a great deal. He's been writing about desire. When I was growing up as a little Catholic kid, to desire anything, desire was ipso facto bad. You want something bad, that's bad. You're not supposed to have desire. In fact, even one of the canons of the Mass says, control our desire, control our desire. Moore is much more profound than that. He has this wonderful statement, desire is love trying to happen. Desire is love trying to happen. This woman wants truth, desires to be with other people. So she doesn't have to control her desire. Rather, she must live off the desire. Huh? Desire for truth and goodness, for her own authenticity. So we do very bad things. We say, oh, you've got to control your desire. No, we don't have to control it. What God calls us to is the transformation of desire. And that's where the cross hits us. It's not an easy transition from my normal self-serving desires to this much larger desire.